Okay, well, thank you. So as Dave said, my lectures are the elementary among the set of lectures, in the sense that this subject was started in the mid-70s, and most of what I'll say, I think, was not all, but most was quickly done in the physics literature. So there are theories about global supersymmetry, which is mostly what I'll talk about, and then there are theories of gravity as well. And I think a lot of the effort in the supersymmetry literature is towards the supergravity. And the crowning glory of that is the sort of maximal theory, which is the supergravity in 11 dimensions, and that one was constructed in 1978, about this time of year. So I think we're exactly 20 years out of date in that sense, but hopefully not out of date in the sense that John Morgan said. And so as I say, in the physics literature, I think almost everything I'll say you'll find there. And in the math literature, well, I remember when I was first exposed to this subject in the early 80s, I think it was quite confusing, certainly for me, and I think for most mathematicians, to understand what are these anti-commuting variables. And I think, well, people eventually realized how to do that, and they can even find that written down in some math papers. And I also remember when I was at Harvard, well, in Boston, MIT, in the mid-80s, I remember sitting with Raoul Bott in the back of a lecture with Joseph Bernstein explaining to us exactly how we should think about them, and Raoul said, no, we can't do that. So I'm afraid this first lecture is going to be a little bit of deja vu for Raoul, because I've come to understand that that's exactly how we mathematicians are supposed to think of these anti-commuting variables. So the first lecture, before we talk about supersymmetry, which is some sort of symmetry between bosons and fermions, we have to understand what are fermions. And so this first lecture will be exactly about that topic, what are fermions. And then the other lectures, I was starting to write the titles. Well, let me just write the titles. So the fourth title will be Theories with Two Supersymmetries. And the last lecture, the plan is it will be Theories with More Supersymmetries. Okay, so in the lecture, so I'm going to try to do a mixture of things, which is partly to give, especially for the mathematicians among us, a firm foundation for thinking about supersymmetry, thinking about these odd variables, and I'm also reviewing some basic notions about the classical physics and even a little bit about the quantum physics, so we have the right language and framework in which to think about these things. And on the other hand, I also want to sort of convey a lot of information without doing the detailed computations in a qualitative way, at least, to describe, a more descriptive way, let's say, to describe the different theories in the different dimensions to help follow the other talks. Now, that may or may not work, since a lot of that description will be towards the end of the week, and maybe by that time you will have needed that background, but there's no getting around that. Okay, so certainly a lot of what I'll say is classical physics as opposed to quantum physics, and even the quantum part, it's going to be, so to speak, formal or kinematical. Nothing about the dynamics of supersymmetry, which are the great achievements in the last several years, and I guess some of those in the string theory context will be the subject of Dave's lectures. So we had this very intensive program last year at the Institute for Advanced Study where I learned much of this. And so on the physics side, certainly from Ed Witten and from Nadi Seiberg, I think, so the main things about the supersymmetry. And on the math side, from Pierre Deligne, who's sitting here, and John Morgan, and Joseph Bernstein, and Kajdan, and so on. So all their influence will show through in this lecture. As far as written materials, there are materials being produced from those from that program, some of which is available already on the web. The web address is available, if you like, from Dave Morrison, and some of it is being written as we speak, so to say. Okay. Now, I was told the lecture will be, well, an hour and a half. Well, there's a lot of material here, so when more than 10 people are asleep, that's when I'll stop. So in a way, this first lecture, just to finish the introduction, is to explain why, if we integrate a formula, why, supposing that psi is a function with compact support, so I'm not really worrying about the convergence of this integral, how can this thing be non-zero? You see, if psi is an ordinary function, then we would write that 1/2 of psi psi dot is the total derivative of psi squared, and if I integrate the total derivative of a function of compact support, I certainly get zero. And this is, so to speak, the first formula that you might run into the typical Lagrangian or typical action of a supersymmetric theory. This would be the simplest you would write down, and for a mathematician, that looks like zero. So what I have to explain is that it is, in fact, zero in some sense, but that it's also not zero in some sense, and we have to understand how to understand that as being non-zero. So a physicist says that psi is anti-commuting, and this little manipulation is, of course, not valid. But we have to understand how to interpret that. So that's the subject, what are fermions? Now, so the structure of the lecture is that I'll remind you a little bit about what are fermions in quantum physics, and then we'll talk a little bit about the mathematics behind that, which is fairly standard for mathematicians, I think. It's very algebraic. And then we'll talk a little bit about what are the fermions classically, and then we'll see how to interpret that mathematically. So that's the plan. So starting with the quantum mechanics, remember that in quantum mechanics, the basic object is a complex Hilbert space. So I hope the physicists will excuse me for saying very, very elementary things during these lectures. It's a complex Hilbert space, and we think of a state of whatever system we're in as being described by a vector in this complex Hilbert space. And more precisely, we think of vectors that are related to each other by a phase, or perhaps even by a complex number, to represent the same physical state. So if we have a normalized state, it has norm 1, and then we have a phase which rotates vectors which represent the same state. So one context is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. That's the sort of thing you would run into in an undergraduate course in quantum mechanics when you think of, say, a particle moving in, let's say, some m-dimensional Euclidean space. And then the Hilbert space that represents that, the complex Hilbert space, will be L2 functions on the space with values in some complex vector space W. So W is a complex vector space, which is a representation of the group spin M. So SOM, the group of symmetries of the Euclidean space, acts on the space where I think of my particle going, and we can think of the Hilbert space, which describes the quantum particle, as being L2 functions with values in some representation, which we also allow to be a representation of spin. So typically, if we just have a scalar particle, this is just the complex numbers, and we're looking at complex functions in Rm. Now, there's a notion of the spin of a particle, or the spin of a representation of spin m. So physicists will refer to particles of spin 0, spin 1/2, spin 1, and so on. And what that means when we have a representation is that we just decompose under some copy of spin 2 sitting inside spin m. So again, thinking in terms of the orthogonal groups, it's just the rotations of some two-plane sitting inside spin m. And of course, any representation here, complex representation, is just one complex dimensional, and it's described by what we take to be a half integer. So we take the basic representation to be spin 1/2, and then we can have the various multiples, or spin minus 1/2. And so when we decompose a representation, we'll get maybe some invariance, spin 0, we'll get some things of spin 1/2, minus 1/2, 1, minus 1, and so on. And we say that the spin of the representation is just the highest of those numbers which occurs, the largest positive number. So if all the numbers are 0 and 1/2, we say the representation is spin 1/2. So for example, the representation which is trivial, which just has the complex numbers, is spin 0. That's the only representation which occurs. And the spin representation would be spin 1/2. And for example, if we take m equals 3, and we take just the vector representation, so So that means spin 3 acting through SO3 on, well, it acts on R3, but we think of it as complex, then this representation has spin 1. So it's the three-dimensional representation which has spin 1, and that's what's called a vector particle in three dimensions. So that's the non-relativistic view, and that's the Hilbert space that we get. The relativistic view, so if we have relativistic, quantum mechanics, or what we see in quantum field theory, is that, in fact, the H is a representation of the Poincaré group. So here, the underlying symmetry group would be the Galilean group, and now we get the Poincaré group. So what is the Poincaré group? So let's let Mn be n-dimensional Minkowski space, okay. So I think of this as an affine space. In other words, I don't fix an origin. There's no reason to fix a preferred point in space-time, but the underlying vector space, so V, which is R1 n minus 1, is the underlying vector space. So when I write formulas, I'll always take a coordinate system, which where the coordinates are x0, x1 up through xn minus 1. You can think of x0 as being the speed of light times time, so that's the time direction. And the xi's for positive I are the spatial directions. And the metric is the x0 squared minus the x1 squared minus dx n minus 1 squared. Okay? So that should fix the conventions about Minkowski space. And now the Poincaré group, let's call it Pn, is the Poincaré group of symmetries. So it includes the translations, because we have an affine space. We have the translation group, and we also have the spinner group, which acts here, the Lorentz group. So in other words, there's a subgroup of translations, and the quotient is isomorphic to the group spin 1 n minus 1. So here are the translations. Okay, and that's the connected spin group. Now, so as I say, the Hilbert space are going to be unitary complex representations of this Poincaré group. And so the representation theory of that dates much more than 20 years. That goes back to a story of Wigner. And we will need that in a later lecture, so let's just review that very quickly. So if we have a representation, say an irreducible unitary representation of the Poincaré group, we can restrict it to the group of translations. And the representations of the translation group, well, that's an abelian group. So again, just as before when I talked about spin 2, which is abelian, here the representations are all one-dimensional. So they're just given by a character, which means the exponential, e to the I times some element really in the dual of V. So we have this picture of the dual space of V, which are the characters, and then we'll get some sum, continuous sum, of characters that occur in some particular representation. And if the representation is irreducible, those the characters which occur will occur on an orbit of the action of the Lorentz group, the spin 1 n minus 1, on V star. So we might have, well, the first possibility, sorry, the zeroth possibility is that we have the trivial representation. So then the only character occurs at the origin. So that's the vacuum state. It's a one-dimensional representation, so that's not very interesting. Another possibility is that it occurs on some orbit which looks like this. And so this is the set of points. So this is the set of points, say C, whose norm squared is equal to some mass squared, m squared, and let's say that this is positive. And we also take only the ones with positive time component. So remember that inside the space, we have the elements of zero norm. So that if n is at least two, at least three, it looks like some hyperboloid. That's the light cone. Looks like some cone, I mean. And so some of the orbits inside have positive mass, which occur here. So those are the massive representations. And we also have the massless representations, which occur an orbit occurring inside the light cone. And in fact, we can we want to take representations of positive energy. And so the orbit will actually be here, this light cone. So this will be mass zero. So then the representation itself, we can think of the representation space as being, the Hilbert space, as being the set of sections of some vector bundle over this. And the whole story has to be equivariant with respect to this Lorentz group action, the spin 1 and minus 1. So in other words, we have an equivariant vector bundle either over this orbit here, these colors, or over this orbit here. And that's an equivariant vector bundle. Now, the way to determine shouldn't be tangent. Sorry, my picture is bad. It should be tangent. Yeah. So the so how do I determine an equivariant vector bundle? Well, I can fix a point, say a point here or a point here, and just ask what's the fiber there. And the fiber there has to be a representation of the stabilizer group of that point. So that stabilizer group is called the little group. So this is the group which stabilizes this point. In the massive case, the group which stabilizes that point is isomorphic to spin n minus 1, just the positive definite. So here I can take the point with coordinates m, first time coordinate m, and the rest of the coordinates 0. And then we see that the group is actually the spatial rotations of x1 through xn. And on the other hand, if we take a point over here, and a typical choice would be something like 1, 1, and the rest zeros, then the little group, well, it's not compact, it's not reductive, but its reductive part, which is the only part that you see in a representation, is isomorphic in a finite dimension, is isomorphic to spin n minus 2. So there it would be the rotations of x2 up through xn minus 1. What does reductive mean? Reductive means if I look at the Lie algebra, there's some nilpotent, some upper triangular. So I mod out by that. So it's the quotient by that, I think. So those things get represented trivially. Yeah, it's actually Euclidean group, I think. I think it's isomorphic to the Euclidean group. So I'm modding out by the translations. Because those translations get represented trivially in a finite dimensional. So there's a physical statement there that the representation has a sort of finite number of polarizations, you would say, I think. Right. I figured. So it's that lets us reduce to that. Okay. So when we classify these representations, then, we have to look at complex representations of these groups. Now, so in the massive case, we're looking at complex representations of spin n minus 1, which is exactly what we were looking at in the relativistic case, in the non-relativistic case. And in the massless case, then, we have this new phenomenon of representations of spin n minus 2. So, for example, in four dimensions, that's what we looked at before, where we had a particle in, say, R3. So here now we have four dimensions because we're including time. In four dimensions, we could take a vector representation here, which now just has two dimensions. Okay. So the vector particle, the spin 1 particle in four dimensions, which is massless, has, physicists would say, two polarizations, which means that the dimension of this vector bundle, the rank of this vector bundle, is 2. Whereas in the massive case, the rank is 3. Well,
you're not including T or P.
Right. I didn't include that. So there's one more physical principle which I was hoping to finesse until Joel Polchinski answers my question about it, or you will, which I'll explain on Wednesday, called CPT, once I understand it a little bit better. And there's a restriction on these representations, which is that we have to include one more transformation that's not in the connected component. Okay, and that will restrict the given representations. But I'm afraid I have some slight confusions about that and won't try to explain that now. That's right. Well,
no, it's an experimental fact.
Hypothesis. Okay. Okay. So one more comment, by the way. The dual variables to the time and position variables we have here with the right factor of h bar, we can think of them as energy and momentum. And and of course we have the relativistic equation that the mass squared is the energy squared minus the momentum squared. I'll even get my units correct if I put in the factors of C. Okay. And now we should think of, typically we think of these representations as, say, if we had an irreducible one, as representing a given particle. So physicists talk in a quantum field theory about the one particle Hilbert space, which means it's a sum, a finite sum, usually, I guess, of irreducible representations which describe the particles. But if we had a free theory, at least, then we would take tensor products. We would take the so-called Fock space that would describe many particle states. So in particular, if we have two particles, so suppose we have, say, Hi is, say, H1 and H2 describe some particles of type 1 and 2. And so if we have a state that's, you know, some particle of type 1 in some given state here, say V1, and a particle here, V2, then of course we can form the tensor product space, the tensor product state, V1 tensor V2, in the tensor product that would describe the state consisting of a particle of type 1 in this state, particle of type 2 in this state. Now, when you have identical particles, then H1 is equal to H2. In other words, we could also think of having two particles of the same type. So let's now take H1 equals H2, so identical particles. And then if we take this state and compare it to this state, saying that they're identical particles should mean that those give me the same state. And as I said at the beginning, saying we have the same state means that there's some phase, lambda, which, so lambda is just element of the circle group, in other words, a unit norm complex number, and e to the I theta for some theta, and that describes these. So now if I switch this again, then of course I should pick up somehow lambda squared. The operation of switching means multiplication by lambda. And so we get back the same state with lambda squared. Now, again, this is a physical argument that I'm missing at this point, which is that usually this is taken, at least in dimension bigger than 2, that lambda squared is equal to 1. Okay. So usually we say we get back to the same state. We want to get back exactly the same vector. And that leads to two possibilities, which is that lambda is equal plus 1 or minus 1. Even if there are more possibilities, we could certainly consider those possibilities. So lambda equals plus 1 is called a boson, and lambda equals minus 1 is called a fermion. So the representation somehow comes with this characteristic of what happens when you switch two identical particles. It's either a boson or a fermion. Now, in quantum field theory, there's a connection between the spin of the representation that I talked about and this choice, which is called the statistics. That's the spin statistics theorem. And so in a unitary quantum field theory, a particle of integral spin is a boson. It's plus one. And a particle of half integral spin is a fermion, spin minus one. But that needn't be the case if we don't have a unitary quantum field theory. So, for example, topological quantum field theories, often this spin statistics connection is not obeyed. Okay.
Are you introducing that as an equivalence relation and taking the quotient of H tensor H?
Yes. So, how do we describe that mathematically? So, what we would say is that our one particle Hilbert space, we would write it as a sum where I put all the bosons here and all the fermions here. In other words, we think of this as a graded vector space where I have a Z2 grading, and all the grading is a sort of bookkeeping device, and the even part is the bosons, H0, the odd part, H1, are the fermions. And now, if I have a two-particle state, I would say that I should take actually not the tensor product, but SIM2, symmetric tensor product. And when I take the symmetric tensor product, I get the symmetric tensor product of H0 with itself. That's describing two bosons. I get another piece, which is H0 tensor H1. That's the states that are one boson and one fermion. And there's no way to permute these. H1 tensor H0 is just a different space. And then the other space I get is when I have two fermions. Well, we might call it SIM2. We'd like to call it SIM2. But we really want this space to come out to be wedge 2. So if I think of this as an ordinary vector space, I really want it wedge 2, so that when I switch these, I get a minus sign. Right? And so that's how fermions behave, that I should get a wedge 2 here. Physically, that wedge 2, saying that we get a 0 if V1 is equal to V2, that's called the Pauli exclusion principle, which is a very important physical principle that holds me together, I guess, enough to give these lectures, although not enough to explain the physics of the Pauli exclusion principle. But beyond that statement. Mathematically, we want a device where I can really write SIM2 here. And so that's the end of my physical introduction to what is a fermion in quantum mechanics, and let me then go to the mathematics of graded algebras. So of just graded algebra. Algebra not in the sense of an algebra, but algebra in the sense of the subject algebra, meaning we have graded vector spaces, graded algebras, graded Lie algebras, and so on. Yes? Well, if I had two different, suppose H0 means the space of all bosons, right? But supposing. Yes. So. Oh, why take the tensor product? Yeah, there is, but I might plead that in the interest of time, I'll answer your question after, if that's okay. So I'm afraid that I better answer the questions that are more along the lines of the subject, or we won't get there. So I'm happy to try to answer that afterwards. There's a general philosophy somehow that classically you would describe a classical system by taking the sum. For example, if I had a particle moving in ordinary space, R3, and I wanted to describe two particles, it would move in the direct sum of R3 plus R3. When you take the quantum system, you might think heuristically that's some sort of exponential, which turns sums into products. For example, we saw in non-relativistic that we took the space of functions on R3, and now the space of functions on the direct sum is the tensor product of the functions. So that's one sort of answer to your question. That going to the quantum space, you can think of loosely as some sort of exponential, and it turns those sums into products. Okay, so the idea in the super algebra, so super means Z2 graded, is that the algebraic objects, like vector spaces, Lie algebras, and so on, that we are familiar with, we think of the underlying vector space, let's say, or underlying modules, as being now graded vector spaces, where we have an even piece and an odd piece. And we introduce a sign rule that tells us every time we write down equations, and we end up in these equations commuting to elements which are homogeneous, then we introduce a sign. So in other words, it says that supposing I have elements, to an element A, which is homogeneous, let's write its parity as being either 0 or 1 according as to whether A is in W0 or A is in W1. So we'll just introduce that symbol for its parity. And then every time that I switch the order, so for example, if I have not a graded vector space, but now a graded algebra where I can multiply these elements, then if these are homogeneous elements, I introduce a sign, which is -1 to the product of the parities. And the idea is that we consistently follow this sign rule. We write down the definitions, the equations, and so on of our ordinary algebraic objects. We consistently write down the sign rule, and we'll be led to the corresponding objects here. For example, if I have an odd vector space, like this H1, and I take sim2, and I write down the rule that in the symmetric product, if I take A, let's call that symmetric product, that this is B minus A. You see, that's my usual rule when I take the symmetric product of two elements in a symmetric algebra. But in writing this equation down, I've switched the order of B and A, so I should get a sign which is -1 to the product of the parities. And if this is odd, if this is an odd vector space, then both these parities are 1, and then I'll actually get a minus sign. So in other words, the symmetric algebra on an odd vector space is what we would ordinarily think of as the exterior algebra. Okay, so the sign rule works like that. And let me just give a few examples. So one example is a graded Lie algebra. Okay, so you remember that a Lie algebra means that we have a vector space which has a bracketing operation from G tensor G to G. In other words, given two elements in the Lie algebra, I get another element, a sort of product. But the product is skew symmetric. In other words, bracket of AB is minus bracket of BA, and it satisfies the Jacobi identity. So now when I want to define what a super Lie algebra is, then I just want to say that this G is now a graded vector space. So it has both an even piece, G0, and an odd piece, G1. And again, I have this bracketing operation, as before, now on the full tensor product of these sums. And again, I have this Jacobi identity. But notice that in writing this down, I've switched the order of B and A. So since I've switched the order, I have to introduce a sign, which is -1 to the parity of A, parity of B, assuming that both elements are homogeneous. Okay, the Jacobi identity will involve additional signs. Okay. So, for example, if we look at this product, you see that it's skew symmetric on G0. If I have two elements of G0, it's some sort of product between elements of G0 and G1, which lands you in G1. And on two elements of G1, it will land me back into G0, but it will be a symmetric pairing. So this pairing will actually be a symmetric pairing from G1 tensor G1 to G0. Implicit in what I said is that this pairing is an even pairing. In other words, it preserves the total degree. So if I take two elements, if I take an odd element here and an odd element here, the total element in this tensor product is even, and it will map to an even element here. So that's why the product of two elements in G1 lands back in G0. So all the operations we're assuming are even. They preserve parity. Okay. Now, there's a device which in this context I think of as a computational device for computing with these odd elements. You see, you're going to get into a mess of signs. This whole subject is a mess of signs. So an awful mess of signs. And I'll try through these lectures to give a consistent set of sign conventions for all the different places where signs come up. But it's really, I'm afraid, just a terrible mess. We're getting there. And you can ask at the appropriate time. And so there's a device for keeping track of signs, if you like, a device, which is that instead of, if I think of these Lie algebras as being over the reals, so usually our ground field is the reals or perhaps the complex numbers. We could work over other ground fields. But if I think of it as being the reals, then instead of working over the reals, I will allow myself to replace the ground field of the reals with any R, which is a super commutative algebra. So in other words, I'll work now over a ring, so with modules rather than vector spaces, but I'll work over a super commutative algebra. Now in practice, this means that we take R to be the algebra generated by some elements, eta 1, eta 2, up through some eta n, where the etas are odd. Okay. So this is the algebra generated by these symbols. So this is like a polynomial algebra. You see, supposing we just had one eta, and I told you instead of being odd that this was an even variable x. Well, I would write r bracket x would be the thing generated over the reals with x. That would just be all the polynomials. You'd write all expressions which were polynomials. And similarly here, you write all polynomials in these variables. But since they're odd, we have the eta I and eta j anti-commute. So again, I take it as a polynomial algebra, the usual commutation. But instead of saying they commute, since in writing this equation I switch the order of eta I and eta j, I pick up a minus sign. So these anti-commute. And in fact, this is then a finite dimensional ring. Just looks like an exterior algebra on those elements. This is what you would call a Grassmannian algebra. Right, exterior algebra or Grassmannian algebra. And so, in other words, we replace the Lie algebra G by R tensor G. So I allow myself to introduce these constants. So physicists are very used to, I think, having these constants around and, in fact, having as many as you need. And we can work with them. So, for example, if we wanted to know this Jacobi identity, so let's say that A and B are both odd, and let's say that we introduce parameters eta 1 and eta 2, then if I want to compute the Lie bracket of eta 1 of A with B, you see these are both odd elements, and I'm more comfortable working with even elements, so I might just multiply by these parameters, and now this total element is even, and this total element is even. And when I have even elements, I know what my Lie algebra is. Those are the things I wrote without the yellow, just the straight rules. So when I commute these, I pick up a minus sign, eta 2b, eta 1a. Right? But now I can work to bring these constants. These are just to be thought of as the ground ring, so I can just move them all to the left. But I have to be careful that when I commute the eta 2, which is odd, past the a, which is odd, I pick up a sign. So this term here is equal to minus eta 1, eta 2, a bracket b. And this term, well, I want to move the a to 1. Let's just move it past both of these. This is even, so I move a to 1 past. I don't pick up a sign. So I have minus a to 1, a to 2, b bracket a. So now I can cancel the a to 1, a to 2, and get my law that the that this product is symmetric on two odd elements.
Why do you have to, you don't have to have the a to anti-commuting with any
The etas anti-commute with themselves, but when I take this tensor product, what I mean is that when I multiply two even elements, I get an even element. When I multiply an even by an odd, I get an odd. When I multiply an odd by an odd, I get an even. In other words, this is what we call a graded tensor product. So A is odd and eta 1 is odd, and so this total element is even. Now, the fact that they anti-commute rather than do something more complicated is what I mean in a sense by saying these are scalars. Well, commuted, oh, I see. Well, in this context, the word commute means commute with a minus sign. super commute, we might say. But if you took them to commute without the minus sign, then that would be a different sort of tensor product. So we really want to... Well, then it wouldn't turn A into... You see, then eta times A in total wouldn't look like an even element. It would look like an odd element.
So if you did the other way and you forget those scatters, then you would not get the algebra, or see the algebra in even on the even.
Okay. Well, now I have more bad news. So if you think it's bad news that that's there, then the next two examples are even worse news. So again, as a mathematician, the philosophy is to try to use a consistent set of a minimal number of rules, which we tend to communicate in telegraphic style that we missed that we were communicating so much. And the rule is here that when you... Yes, I'm using the graded tensor product. This is the graded tensor product. The claim is that I better work that out after the lecture. I don't think I can work that out on my feet right now. Sorry. Right. All right. Well, let's postpone that till after the lecture, I think. But my convention will be that I'll always talk about graded tensor products. And so products of two odd elements will always be even. And I will use the sign rule in commuting these scalars with the elements of the algebra. Okay, so for example, I didn't write the Jacobi identity, but you can work out the various cases if you have two odd elements and one even element and so on. Then I think of using these etas in this context as simply a computational security to not make sign mistakes, because then I can write down the usual Jacobi identity and then just move the etas. And that to me makes less sign mistakes than if I just tried to think of commuting the elements without the etas. So I think of it purely as a computational device. In a more formal mathematical way, what we're doing is working functorially over this category of all these algebras. And so, in other words, we're thinking of the functor which assigns to each such ring. We take this graded tensor product, and we're really always working only with the even elements, like this. So in other words, instead, as an alternative to considering graded Lie algebras here, even in odd elements, what we're saying is allow these base rings and then work only with ordinary Lie algebras, because these are the even elements. These will be ordinary Lie algebras, but with these extended scalars. And so these are two equivalent points of view. And in this algebraic context, as I say, you might think of it as just purely a computational device. When we come to the geometric context, this will be absolutely crucial to a geometric understanding of what's going on. In this algebraic context, I think it's just a device. And again, I think it matches the physicist's use of these auxiliary parameters, these auxiliary odd parameters. You always have them around. You always have as many as you need. That's mathematically expressed that we're working functorially over all rings. And so in a given expression, we may need more parameters, and they're there. Now, a few examples of signs where the physics literature, as I say, in some places will differ from usual mathematical conventions. Okay. So the first one is, let's suppose that A is an algebra, an ordinary algebra over the complex numbers. So this is now a complex algebra. And let's say what's a real structure. So a real structure is a map from A to A, or really I think of it to the conjugate, as a real structure. But let me write it as a map from A to A with the following three properties. One is that it's antilinear. So if I take the conjugate of a scalar times A, I get lambda bar times A star. So here lambda is a complex scalar, and A is an element in the algebra. So this real structure is antilinear. It's idempotent, which means that if I apply it twice, I get back to A. That's a real structure. And that's just saying so far what is a real structure on a vector space over the complex numbers. When I have the multiplication, I have to say how this star interacts with the multiplication. And so I have to tell you what's the star of a product. And typically, that's the product of the stars in the opposite order. So for example, if we have complex matrices, which is an algebra, and I want to tell you a real structure, we might take the star, which is the conjugate transpose, and then the real elements, the elements where A star is equal to A, are the Hermitian matrices. And they obey this sort of law. Or for example, in the quaternions, you might find such similar laws. And in situations in mathematics where you have this real structure in an algebra, you'll have this law. I think that everyone would agree on that. Now let's go over to the super case. So in the super case, I should have left a little.
Before you leave the ordinary case,
yes.
Take the algebra of n by n complex matrices.
Yes.
Why the star conjugation?
Well, that's it. Well, okay. The transpose conjugate has better properties. For example, the eigenvalues of a real matrix in that situation are actually real.
Well, when I think of a real structure of n by n matrices, by God, I think of conjugate.
As a vector space, probably.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Okay. Okay, so if I take this to be the definition, then if I have now a graded algebra, super algebra, then in this last law, I've commuted A and B. And so I should pick up a sign, which is minus 1 to the parity of A, parity of B. Okay. So this has the consequence that if A is commutative, which means commutative with the signs, then the conjugate of the product is actually the product of the conjugates in this order, always. So if we accept this sign convention for real, and we can discuss whether that's the good mathematical convention or not, then the consequence is that if I have a supercommutative algebra, the conjugate of a product is the product of the conjugates always in the same order. In other words, we pick up this sign, that's the correct law, but then because it's commutative, I commute them back and pick up the same sign. And so the signs cancel. So for example, if we have a real element, if we have two real elements, then their product is also real. Okay. So we'll see that convention in the last lecture when we compute in superspace in four dimensions. Now, a second place where... it's not that of Wessenberg. Okay. I'm not going to try to say what their conventions are or aren't. But the conjugate of d by d theta will be d by d theta bar. Okay. The conjugate of theta will be theta bar. And the product of two real thetas will also be real. I think that vastly simplifies the kinds of computations you do in classical supersymmetry. I think that's correct. Although I don't think that's what you said initially. Now, the second point is, what is a super Hilbert space? So this one is, I'm afraid, worse. Because a Hilbert space, one of the axioms for the inner product is that when I take V1 inner product V2 and I switch the order, I get V2 V1 with a conjugate. That's the usual axiom for the inner product in a Hilbert space. And of course, now that I've switched the order, I should get, I'm afraid, a sign there. because I've switched the order of these two elements. So that means that if I take the norm squared of an element, in other words, V, inner product V, then if V is even, as usual, then V, norm V squared is real. So this has the consequence that V is real if V is even. But I'm afraid it's purely imaginary if V is odd. And that's a rather strange convention, I think, for physicists, that the norm squared of an element there should be real. And incidentally, you usually require that a positivity, that this is positive when this is here, and then we need some positivity also in the negative, in the odd space, which is, I think, that sign is the good one. And, well, this leads to strange conventions. For example, you can work out for yourself what are the eigenvalues of a linear operator, which is odd, a self-adjoint linear operator, which is odd. So this would be quite a different convention. On the other hand, it's somehow the quantum version of what's going on there. Okay, so anyway, the idea, we can argue about the details of what should constitute the definitions, but the idea of carrying over a structure to account for fermions in quantum mechanics, just the formal structure, that aspect of quantum mechanics to allow the non-commuting variables, so to speak, there, I think is fairly standard in mathematics. We don't need really new ideas. We just have algebra now over rings which aren't commutative, and that's, of course, a very standard idea. So now we want to go over to the classical world. And if we think about our particle, and let's just think about, so we often get these quantum Hilbert spaces by quantizing a classical model. And again, there's a non-relativistic story having to do with a particle moving in space, and there's a relativistic story having to do with fields in space-time and solving wave equations. And today we'll just talk about the more familiar and simpler context of a particle moving in space. So, I'm afraid I used W again, where I used W before, but okay. So let's think of a classical particle. So I want to review how it is that we describe a classical particle and how we go from that description to to the quantum mechanical Hilbert space, the non-relativistic Hilbert space. So in other words, a classical particle we think of as a map from the reals, which represents time, into some space, which is Rm. And I'll call this, I guess I'll use U. Okay, so U, well, I've used V and W for vector spaces, and I need another letter. So I guess I'll use, let me use capital X, actually. So X will be a vector space. I'll just call it X0, the 0 reminding us that this is to be thought of as even. This is ordinary space. And we said that the quantum mechanical Hilbert space that corresponds simply to this is L2 functions on space, L2 functions on this x0. Now, how do we get there? Well, in the classical physics, what we have, so we have our particle described as so, and we have the classical equation of motion. And the classical equation of motion here is Newton's law. So if we assume that there are no external potential, no external forces, the classical equation of motion is simply that the acceleration be zero. Okay. And of course, we could have a potential, and then we would have a more complicated law. But let's do it without a potential. Okay. And so the space of solutions. So then we have the space of classical solutions. Well, this is a second-order differential equation. So, in fact, the space of solutions is a space M naught. It's described by these trajectories, which have constant velocity. And in fact, it's a vector space. I could add two trajectories just by adding pointwise. And we usually describe it by fixing an initial time, t naught. And then to solve this equation, we need to give an initial position and an initial velocity. So we can describe that initial position and velocity as being a point in the tangent bundle to x naught. Okay. So that's the initial position, initial velocity. The other element in the classical story is that we have a symplectic structure from M. And the symplectic structure, well, so the formula for it will be something like this. Okay, so for the differential on the space of x's, I'm using delta. And so this is a two-form. And here I've described it again by fixing an initial point t naught, and this whole structure would be independent of t naught. In other words, if I make this isomorphism by considering a different initial point, I would get the corresponding symplectic form. And little m there is the mass of the particle. Now, this symplectic manifold, in other words, the equations of motion, the space of solutions, and the symplectic structure, are all very nicely gotten, usually in a Lagrangian framework. So usually we describe a Lagrangian which we write as something like L equals 1 half norm x dot of t squared dt. And so for each path, whether or not it solves the equation of motion, but for each path, we can compute this, which is a density on the line, and we can integrate it over time, or integrate it between two fixed times, to get the action, the classical action. And we get this by doing the variational problem. Now, tomorrow I'll review all that systematically and how we do that in higher dimensions. So for today, I won't emphasize this Lagrangian point of view, but rather talk about what we obtain here. Now, an equivalent way to describe the symplectic form is to say that we have a Poisson bracket on functions. And the bracket here says that if I take x dot I at some time t, or t naught. So if I fix the basis, this is the ith component of the velocity, and I bracket it with xj at time t naught, then I get the inverse metric gij. Okay. So again, we'll review all that, and I suppose I left off a factor of m. How we go from the Lagrangian to here. But the question that concerns us now is, how do we quantize this? To review, how do we quantize this? Now, oh gosh, I did skip.
Your GIJ is delta IJ?
It's delta IJ in this case, yeah. Now, I'm afraid, you see, when I wrote this lecture this morning, I had an insert that went before that answered Dave's question. Well, it'll be inserted at some other point. So, days. So when we quantize, well, one story is that we have this vector space. This is now a symplectic vector space, and we polarize it. So we write Tx naught as x naught, or x sum x naught. So this is a polarization into Lagrangian submanifolds. So this would be the initial position, the initial velocity. And then the Hilbert space is taken to be L2 functions on one of these copies. So there's the story about polarizing and getting that. And in fact, the complex L2 functions, that's the correct answer. And if we take different polarizations, what we find is that the Hilbert space is well-defined only as a projective space, which is exactly what we want for this quantum space of states. Another point of view is that we want to represent these functions now. We want to represent functions as operators on some Hilbert space. And if we have two functions, f1 and f2, then so it maps a function to an operator. And the bracket of two operators corresponding to two functions should be related to the Poisson bracket, the operator of the Poisson bracket. And I think the right sign is minus I h bar. And so again, we want to represent this Poisson bracket, and so we represent it on this Hilbert space. Now that's the standard story to try to get a ordinary complex Hilbert space out of a particle. And the question really is, can we get a graded Hilbert space? If we want to describe fermions, is there a way to get a graded Hilbert space by quantizing something classical? Again, we're asking the question here in the context of particles. We could also do it for fields. Well, the idea is that when we get to this stage that we want to quantize, well, you see, here we're polarizing this even vector space, and we're taking L2 functions, which is, again, an even vector space, a Hilbert space, or we have these operators which in the Poisson bracket, which is skew symmetric. And so the idea that you might find would be that we should replace this particle moving in an ordinary space, x naught, by a particle moving in, instead of, say, an even vector space, maybe moving in a graded vector space, or a particle simply moving in, to take an extreme case, an odd vector space. And then if we go through the same thing, calculus, you might hope in some way that when we end up with the Poisson bracket, we end up with a graded Poisson bracket. And then we will represent that as a graded algebra on some graded Hilbert space. And that's how we'll get to the graded Hilbert space. So if you think of the problem that way, then it seems natural to consider to replace x naught by an odd vector space, or in general, perhaps a graded vector space, but let's just do an odd vector space, x1. So, yes. Well, so I'm answering the question as a mathematician. In other words, I'm not going to tell you at the moment what the physics of that is, certainly. Okay, I'll comment on that later. But as a mathematical device for going through this process and getting an odd Hilbert space at the end, or getting a graded Hilbert space, we might just try this. So we're trying this at the moment as a theoretical abstraction. As you say, we're in the ITP. Okay, so now we would ask exactly what replaces these notions. And so now our psi will be a map from R into this x1. Of course, we'll have to evaluate exactly what that means. And we'll have our equation of motion. And in this context, it turns out that the right equation of motion is, rather than second order, just first order. So we'll somehow see that. And the classical solutions will now be an odd vector space, which is what we wanted. It's just our original vector space, x1, just the constant paths. And we'll also get a symplectic structure. So the symplectic structure will, again, be a two-form on the space. And in fact, it will be, I guess there's a factor of m, but the important point is it's delta psi of t wedge delta psi of t. So there's no time derivative corresponding to the fact that this was first order rather than second order. And again, this looks like the type of expression that would vanish. We're wedging something with itself. So just as at the beginning of the lecture, we had an expression which would vanish. But now, because of our sine rule, we know that when we commute things which are odd, and these psi's are odd, that we don't get something which vanishes. And again, we have Poisson brackets. And the Poisson brackets would be that psi I of t, psi j of t, is now minus gij. In particular, it's positive in the sense that the Poisson bracket of psi i with itself is negative. That's the correct positivity. So in a formal way, we might think that we work this way. And then when we go to quantize, well, we might again try to polarize. We might try to write this space, M, which is x1, as the sum of two maximal isotropics. So here, this x1, it's an odd vector space with a skew form. But if we forget about the signs and that it's odd, it looks like an even vector space with a symmetric form. And in fact, it's just an even vector space with our original metric. But so what does it mean to polarize? I'm supposed to find isotropic subspaces. Well, positive definite metrics don't have isotropic subspaces. And so we have to complexify. Well, again, that's familiar in geometric quantization, that sometimes we look at complex polarizations rather than real ones. Now we run into a problem if this is odd dimensional, because then it's hard to write it as the sum of two Lagrangians. So really, we have to assume that the dimension is even. And then we can write this as L plus L prime, let's say, where these are now complex isotropic subspaces. And now we can take our Hilbert space to be L2 functions on L. But remember, this L is odd. And so again, we have to face the issue of what do we mean by functions on this odd vector space. Okay. Even here, when I say I map the reals into this odd vector space, what do we mean? Right? One thing we can mean by map between manifolds is we mean a pullback of functions. And so I have to know what are the functions here that I'm pulling back to get functions on the reals. So in both contexts, we have to talk about what we mean by functions on this odd vector space. So, well, there's a natural, again, algebraic definition. So if we have an even vector space, okay, so if W naught is an even vector space, then we have the C infinity functions on W. Those are the nice functions. But we have this rather nice algebraic subset of the symmetric algebra on the dual. In other words, polynomial functions on W naught. And those are very beautiful. They separate points and so on. And we can work with polynomials in a very algebraic way. So now if we take an odd vector space, then we might think to define the C infinity functions on W to be actually equal to the symmetric algebra on the dual. Because after all, this is an odd vector space. And the symmetric algebra on the dual looks like a Grassmann algebra, an exterior algebra. This is just finite dimensional. So in this context, this L2, well, L2, C infinity, they all don't mean much because this is a finite dimensional space, which looks just like the exterior algebra on one of these factors. And in fact, you should recognize that as one construction of the spinner representation. Right? So again, we're getting the spinner representation of the orthogonal group underlying this vector space. And in fact, again, if we switch polarizations, we'll find it's defined only up to the projective spin representation is well defined, which is the correct notion. So the corresponding Hilbert space here, the quantization formally will be the spinner representation, but it's graded into even and odd pieces. And so we've succeeded in getting a graded Hilbert space as our quantization from this classical model. So that's the way, really, in which one can see these quantum fermions, the odd vector spaces, or graded vector spaces, is coming as quantizations of something classical. But it begs the question of what is psi? Right? And so, finally, we have to answer that question of what is psi. So how can I think of a function from the reals into this x1? And that's really the point that I think causes the most confusion, certainly caused me the most confusion. Now, the revelation, somehow, that makes it more clear is that, at least at the beginning, the fact that we have anti-commutative functions. You see, we're trying to map now. So what is psi is a map from the reals into x1. So we're trying to map now to a space which has a ring of functions which has anti-commutative elements. Right. So we can think of this as a map from the C infinity functions on X1 back to the C infinity functions R, as usual in geometry. And this is no longer a commutative ring. Now, we might think that that's somehow the fundamental problem in trying to visualize what's going on. But I think that that's a little bit of a red herring, in a sense. The more important point is that this ring consists of nilpotents. Normally, when we have a function on a manifold, we take, and it's non-zero, we take its square, it's non-zero. But here we have functions, which when we take their square, we get zero because of these anti-commuting elements. In fact, the nilpotents are most of the functions. So if I take C infinity of this odd vector space modulo the nilpotents, this is just the reals. This is, after all, an exterior algebra. The nilpotents are any element of positive degree in the exterior algebra, and the quotient is just the zero degree, which is the ground field, the reals. Now, the reals are just the C-infinity functions on a point. Okay. So we're left with the question of how do we work with spaces whose ring of functions consists of nilpotents? And we can ask that question in the commutative case before we ask it in the non-commutative case. In other words, there's something already as a differential geometer who's used to these manifolds sitting here. We have to, and functions being not nilpotent, we have to understand how to deal with this. Now, this is, of course, completely standard in algebraic geometry. But, okay, so let's take as an example, take a space, let's call it T, with C infinity of T being the reals adjoined epsilon, modulo epsilon squared equals 0, where now epsilon is even. So if we took epsilon to be odd, this would be the case of a one-dimensional x1. Would just be the ring of functions would just have one eta, which was odd. Eta squared would be 0. But we'll just take epsilon to be even. And the question is, what does this space look like? So let's ask, what is a map from T into some manifold M? Okay, M. So M is some manifold. Let me call it X. Okay, so what is a map from this to X? Well, again, it's going to be a map from C infinity functions in the other direction, and this is just the ring R adjoined epsilon. So in other words, every function here will be mapped to an element of this ring, and I can describe it as some real number plus another real number times epsilon. Now, when we pull back functions by maps, it has the property that it takes the product of functions to the product of the pullbacks. In other words, this should be an algebra homomorphism. So the fact that this is an algebra homomorphism tells you... So saying that it's an algebra homomorphism tells us that F of a product is the product of the Fs, and it gives us another equation for G. And what that says is that this F of F is simply the value of the function F at some point X. I mean, those are the only such maps on functions where I get a number from a function which has this property. It has to be the value of F at some point. And in fact, G of F is just the directional derivative of F at some tangent vector. Okay. So in other words, if you just write down the multiplication in this ring, work out the equation for G, you'll find the Leibniz rule. So you'll find that this is a derivation. In other words, that this map G is described as the directional derivative of the function evaluated at the point X. So in other words, mapping this space P into X gives us a tangent vector. So it gives us a point of the manifold together with the tangent vector. So what's the picture? You see, here's the space P. P is a point, but we also have this epsilon. Well, this epsilon, it's not really a coordinate because epsilon squared is 0. I can't go some finite distance out. On the other hand, I can go just first order. So I have, so to speak, a first order deformation of this abstract point. And now when I want to map this into some manifold X, well, very simple. I map to a point plus a first-order deformation, which is a tangent vector. So this is a very standard and very nice way that we can see a tangent vector, and we see the abstract space that maps in as having these nilpotents. It would be no different if I declared that this was odd instead of even. It's just that this infinitesimal deformation would be odd, and I would get an odd tangent vector. In other words, something in the tangent space, but viewed as an odd element. Now we might ask, what is a map from X into P? You see, that's more like here, where we have an ordinary manifold mapping into a space with nilpotents. So here we have an ordinary manifold mapping into the space with nilpotents. Well, again, I have to pull back functions. And so I would get a map from the reals adjoined epsilon, where epsilon squared is 0, back to C infinity functions. Now, what can the image of epsilon possibly be? Well, the image of epsilon, whatever it is, its square has to be zero, because this has to preserve the multiplication. And again, there are no nilpotents in this ring of functions. So in other words, epsilon maps to zero, and all I have really is the map which collapses x to a point. So I can't probe these nilpotent directions with an ordinary space. This ordinary space just can't move in those nilpotent directions. And so here, if we follow that through, you see a map from the reals into here is just zero. The only map here is zero. And that's the sense in which I joked that psi was zero. And so what can that possibly mean, then, to have this psi? Well, now we come back to this idea which we had in the algebraic context as a purely computational device. But in this context, it's absolutely crucial, which is the idea of introducing this base ring, R. So what we've said is that if we have a ring of the type we looked at with some of these odd parameters, then the corresponding space is just a point. Geometrically, that's the only thing I can see. That's the ring modulo the nilpotents is just the reals. But we still have these nilpotents, which form a sort of cloud, or fuzz, I don't know what to call it, which is nilpotent. So I think of it as a space with this sort of nilpotent cloud around it. Okay? So we have, so when I think of it as a vector space, when we were doing algebra, we have the even and the odd space. I certainly think of them as having looking the same, right? I mean, with even and odd elements, we can compute with them. But that's purely algebraically. If I start thinking of it as a manifold, well, a vector space is a manifold. We still picture a line or a plane or a space, something like that, an ordinary even vector space. But an odd vector space is a manifold, I'm afraid, is just a point, together with this nilpotent sort of cloud around it. And now we want to map this line, time, into this. And as we said, we can't probe into this nilpotent cloud. So all we get is zero. But the idea, then, is that we introduce this ring. So this was a picture, really, of my space X1. But now the idea is that we work in families. So in ordinary geometry, if we just have a map between manifolds, we might ask to study families of maps at the same time. And if we study a family of maps, well, if I want to know what it is at a particular point, it's just the same information as having one map. I mean, we study families of maps in topology and lots of contexts to do various things, but we can know what that map is by just knowing it on each fiber of the family. But here, what we want to do is work with R replaced by, so to speak, this ring, tensor R. Okay. Well, what that means is that we're going to replace the C infinity functions on R by this ring tensor, the C infinity functions. Or geometrically, we're going to introduce this space, which is, again, a point, but with some nilpotent directions described by this eta. And then we're going to take the product with the reals. So over the point, which is zero, all the eta's being zero, we just have the reals. But now, because of this product, we have these other directions. And so now we can have a map, psi, that truly maps this into this space, this odd vector space, x1, because these eta's now can probe into the nilpotent cloud here. So x1, I want to think of the ring of functions here as being this ring adjoined, say, theta 1 up to theta m. That's m, I guess I call it. That's dimension m. So here I have the thetas. And now these thetas can pull back to these etas. No, x1 was my odd vector space. I just called the basis of the dual thetas. So thetas are coordinates. They're these odd, the basis of the dual, they're these odd functions. And they're here. And to get them, I have to work in this family. So in other words, my map psi, if I work over a point, will honestly be zero. But if I introduce these parameters eta, then I can get a non-trivial psi. But it will always involve the etas. So let me just show you that explicitly. And to really get used to this idea, it's good to work out a few computations like this. So I'll finish it. 7 minutes, I promise. So I didn't say what the Lagrangian was, which gives you this odd particle. But the Lagrangian will look like this. That's an inner product. And we'll study that tomorrow, that Lagrangian. But let's see how that thing can be non-zero. That's how we started. So let's suppose we introduce, so we replace the reals, which was our original time, by now allowing some of these odd parameters. So we replace C infinity functions on the reals by C infinity functions on the reals, adjoin some eta's. Well, let's just adjoin two eta's, okay? Eta 1 and eta 2. And now our map psi, when we pull back on functions, has to be a map from the ring of x1, which was the reals adjoin theta 1 through theta m. Okay. So in particular, each theta I has to map the sum element of this ring. Now again, we're assuming that this map is even. It preserves degree. We're always working with maps which preserve degree. Well, this is an odd element, so we have to have odd elements here. So this will be some function f1 times eta 1, f1 of t, plus a function f2 of t times eta 2 of t, I suppose. Okay. So again, without the etas, this is 0. Theta has to map to 0. There are no odd elements here to map to. But with the etas, I get something non-zero. And now you could work out L, which is 1 half the inner product of psi with psi dot dt. And, oh my God, what do you get? So you get something like eta 1, eta 2 times f1, f2 dot minus f2, f1 dot dt. Okay. So here it is. It's honestly not 0. Right? Here's something that's honestly not 0. Maybe I've missed a factor. But, or a sign. But notice it's multiplied by eta 1, eta 2, which is even. It's a product of two odd elements. And so if I integrate this Lagrangian to get the action, then what I get, of course I'm integrating this over the reals, is I get a number, assuming compact support, times eta 1, eta 2. So in other words, the thing that goes in the action should be a number normally. To each path we got a number. Here it's a number, but it happens to vanish, unless I work in a family. If I work in a family, I have a family of paths, and I should get a function on the base. And indeed, I get a function on the base, something in the ring of functions of this parameter space. But it's, of course, nilpotent. It just lives in the etas. And that's the picture of the classical fermion, that if we just work over a point, an honest point, it vanishes. And somehow that's the right physical idea, too, that we don't have classical fermions, right? Somehow that's some classical manifestation of the Pauli exclusion principle, perhaps. But in any case, we only see the fermions in this sort of nilpotent direction. When we quantize them, they become on an equal footing in that algebraic context with the bosons. But classically, they're definitely on an unequal footing. So our superspace is not, in any sense, on an equal footing between the even and odd parameters, but rather the even and odd parameters differ. Now here we just had an ordinary space, the reals, which was time, and we have these auxiliary parameters. But eventually we'll work with a space which has both even and odd variables, so-called superspace, and we'll still need perhaps these auxiliary parameters. So again, the point of view is that we work functorially over this ring, or over this base space, and everything we do in the classical mechanics is done functorially here, which means from the beginning we just fix this base space, and we can just fix spaces of this form. So in other words, just fix some number of etas. And then our psi takes on this sort of explicit form. We do all the computations. We'll get a space of solutions, which will again be a manifold hybrid over this base. And now, if we chose a different base, we would get a new space of solutions. And when we restricted to the families, we would get the right functoriality. So in other words, everything is done, so to speak, functorially over these base spaces. And that's the sense in which you work with these parameters. And I think it exactly matches what the physicists do, which is always having enough etas around and being able to put them in the computation. It's the mathematical expression of that. Now, that's the last time that I'll introduce these etas. Yes? Well, spinners will come up. They haven't come up here. I haven't described psi as a spinner in any sense. I mean, I've just described psi as a map from time into this odd vector space. In fact, I would take it to multiply as a vector to transform as a vector under the rotation group of x1. Okay. So spinners haven't entered. Okay, so that's the last time, really, that I'll do a computation where I'll explicitly show you these etas. But when I write expressions, where there are some sides being multiplied and so on, you have to remember that classically they're always zero, in the sense that when I work over a point, they're zero. And we have to introduce these auxiliary odd parameters to make mathematical sense and get something which is non-zero. And I think it's a good idea in doing computations a few times to actually put them in and really have a visual image of what they are, and then it's easier to work with. In that sense, this lecture has been a big psychotherapy session for mathematicians. Because, you see, physicists can be told, in much shorter than I told you, that we now have functions which anti-commute and can immediately do computations. Mathematicians have a rather deep psychoanalytical problem, and I hope I've tried to do a group therapy session and address it, so that from now on we can actually write the same formulas as the physicists. In some instances, I hope even write better formulas, and the computations will make sense. So, to formalize this is the study of supermanifolds, and of course there's a lot of things to say. I mean, I'll just finesse it in the sense of working formally and pointing out a few things here and there. One thing I didn't point out was the answer to Dave's question about the sign convention, which I'll include tomorrow. So again, these odd parameters in the quantum sense, in the algebraic sense, I think of as a convenience, but in this classical sense, these supermanifolds I think of as really the essence of the mathematical interpretation. Okay, so tomorrow then we'll discuss supersymmetry a little bit. Thank you.